All right, so I am Sandra Salzer. I'm with the Cecil G. Shepp Center for Health Services Research at the University of North Carolina.
And I'm Annabelle Potvin. I recently finished my undergraduate degree at UW-Madison, and I worked with Dr. Salzer on this research during my time there, and very lucky to be here to be presenting it. So Sandy and I will be talking about the clinician diagnostic practices and patient responses in borderline personality disorder. As sociologists, obviously nothing to disclose there. So we're talking about borderline personality disorder, or BPD, as we'll probably be referring to it throughout the presentation. So I'll talk a little bit about what that actually is. So it's defined overall in the Diagnostic Statistical Manual as a pervasive form pattern of instability in interpersonal relationships, self-image, and affects, and marked impulsivity in a variety of contexts. So to be given the diagnosis, patients only have to meet 5 of the 9 criteria that you see up here. And as you can imagine, within all of those combinations, there's quite a bit of heterogeneity in the diagnoses that patients receive. So with most diagnoses, the question of how a diagnosis occurs is relatively standard or predictable. So this flowchart kind of represents what that process typically looks like. So there's typically an encounter between a patient and a clinician, and then the clinician makes a decision, makes an internal decision or diagnosis about whether or not and how to diagnose a patient, and then communicates that decision to several key parties. First of all, the patient's medical chart, the insurance company, and then finally, in most cases, to the patients themselves. And then following those channels of communication, there's treatment and prognosis, typically. So we wanted to know to what extent this occurs with borderline personality disorder, this typical process. So our main research questions being, how do clinicians communicate the BPD diagnosis with patients, and how do they justify those practices? And then we consider of equal importance, what is the patient perspective of diagnostic communication practices? So to answer these questions, we used a methodological perspective called institutional ethnography, created by a sociologist, Dorothy Smith. So institutional ethnography focuses on discourse as insight into institutional structures. So just to break that down a little bit, what we mean by discourse and then what we mean by institutional structures. So first of all, discourse basically refers to text and speech. So in the clinical encounter, text can mean the DSM, medical charts, or insurance documents. And speech means essentially how people in the field are talking about a particular diagnosis, what the stereotypes of that diagnosis might be, issues of that nature. And then second, institutional structures refer to think about it from kind of a micro to macro progression, the clinician's work site, so whether that's a hospital, a private practice, or a clinic, and then state policies and laws surrounding the clinician's practice, and then even more broadly, the healthcare system itself. So in this case, mainly what third-party payers are involved. So to learn about this discourse, we interviewed 22 BPD experts, mainly clinicians. So the breakdown there was 7 psychiatrists, 5 LCSWs, 8 psychologists, and 2 BPD activists, and together they represented 10 different states. And then to sort of flip the discourse on its head, we interviewed 10 patients with BPD representing 2 different states, and then we also utilized 22 primary textual patient accounts. So these included people writing about their experiences with the disorder in either memoirs or online community message boards. So hopefully having introduced that and given you an understanding of what BPD actually is, I'll turn it over to Sandy to talk about our analysis.
So for our analysis, we used grounded theory. So if any of you are qualitative researchers, this is very widely used. That meant we took the transcripts and we took the memoirs and we started coding them and just trying to see what themes emerged. It was very inductive. And so we continued our interviews until we stopped seeing new themes. So that is how we arrived at our end. So this is a summary of our analysis. I showed you earlier, right, a depiction of what should happen. And you'll see at each of these 3 stages of communication with BPD, In many cases, clinicians are not communicating the diagnosis. So there was not a single clinician in my sample who communicated the diagnosis in all three of these contexts. At most, they used two. And only three clinicians always told the patient about the diagnosis. So that leaves us with questions about how does this affect treatment and prognosis if everyone's not aware of what their diagnosis is. So as one LCSW said, and this was sort of very typical, I don't tell them, oh, I think you have borderline personality disorder. I would never say that to somebody. So how do you get around telling a patient their diagnosis? There are two main strategies that clinicians employ. Either they emphasize axis one and they talk about mood disorders, or they use a lot of euphemism. I think you have some difficulty regulating your emotions. That was a big one. Comes from Marshall Linehan's work, if you're familiar with that. They might say you have borderline traits. There are many people online who are discussing, I think I really might have borderline personality disorder, but my provider said I have just the traits. What does that mean? And then the final one is cluster B symptoms, based on how the DSM categorizes that personality disorder. So, just to walk you through some of these axis wonderlines, again, these are quotes from our data. Patients know that I have to give them a diagnosis, but I only tell them about the axis 1 diagnosis. I don't talk about the axis 2 diagnosis, I just talk about it in more general, practical ways. And euphemistic diagnoses, even when I think that someone has CPD, I always say, you've got borderline features. Another said, I usually reframe it as codependency. So how do you justify as a clinician not telling somebody what their diagnosis is? Well, there's three main ways that clinicians explained what they were doing. The first was talking about the stigma of the label. The second was some providers were anti-labeling in general, and then we'll discuss some exceptions. So here are a series of quotes of people who were really concerned about the stigma. So one provider said, I think it has to be really clear. I think there's such a stigma attached to the diagnosis. I'm like, oh my God, you don't want to be sharing that with people. I don't like the label because of the stigma there. And then the anti-labeling perspective. So this tended to be clustered around like the clinical social workers who would talk the most about being anti-labeling in general. And this one woman said, I don't really believe in borderline. It's not like the diagnosis has been based in anything but the symptoms. I mean, if you say someone has borderline personality disorder, it's not useful, because what are you really saying? So there are some exceptions. The people clustered in the category of exceptions, I mean, who is telling patients? It tends to be psychologists who have a research background and use the DSM regularly in their research practices, and therefore will walk through the criteria step by step with their patients. This also includes people who bill by the hour. We won't fully get into that, but depending on how you're participating with our healthcare system in the United States, depending on whether or not your reimbursement is contingent upon communication of the diagnosis or not, that will shape some of these practices as well. So somebody who was a clinical researcher said, or that was her initial training, and then she became a provider. She said, I spent an entire session around borderline personality disorder because I think when it goes on people's medical records, it has implications for how others might see them, in particular among mental health disorders. So she would actually go through the criteria and then talk to the patients about what they might face when seeking other health care, and how they could talk to their other providers about what their diagnosis meant. So how were clinicians evaluating efficacy here? So again, by and large, most told me that they were not sharing the diagnosis with patients, and they all had many justifications, not just for why they were doing it sort of on a macro level, but some of them were justifying it in terms of what the patients themselves thought. So this provider said, patients don't like it. They don't like that label. And she says, even when I consulted with colleagues, I don't think I've talked to one person who said their patient doesn't feel stigmatized. So she got her legitimacy for her practices based on the fact that she said, no, this is not what my patients want. And then another provider who was involved also with research treatment outcomes. When I asked him how he evaluated that, how did he evaluate that this was improving treatment outcomes by not telling them the label, he said, well, there wasn't a controlled study, so I can't tell you. That's why he used that term. He used regulation disorder. That people got better than they would have if I used another term, but still this was his justification. So I asked the patients what they thought. What do they think of the secrecy surrounding their disorder? And we won't spend time talking about this, but trying to sample from a group that is not informed of their diagnosis is very difficult. All right, so this graphic, and these slides are available online if you want to look at these more closely later. So this standard practice here, not telling the patient the diagnosis, this is what we went over. There's either access one labeling, or there's a euphemistic diagnosis. And then the minority practice of telling the patient split. So on this half here, the outcomes for the standard practice are negative or confusion. So the patient either experiences confusion because it's very difficult to Google emotional dysregulation and come upon a support group or reliable information, or they had a negative experience. So if they did not learn the diagnosis from the provider and they found out by some other means, that didn't go over well. Finding out something has been in your chart for 30 years was not a popular group. And then on the other side, for the minority practice, one patient did have a negative reaction to being told. He said that he felt that the disorder sounded hopeless and he would never get better. It made him feel depressed. Otherwise, the vast majority of patients who were told said that they felt relief, they felt agreement with the label, or they may have had a critical response. So if you can flip ahead, we'll run through it. So agreement, one said, I've had it for at least 20 years. It's a relief to finally be diagnosed. Critical, this is one of the most interesting categories. So a sizable proportion of the people who were told the label had a critical response. And what do I mean by that? I mean, they started to critique the DSM. They started to critique psychiatry. And they were using critiques that other clinicians also used, but they were able to, once they had that label, to start asking questions. They didn't disagree about whether or not they had the disorder. They started asking, what do you mean by personality? So negative versus confusion, again, are outlined up here. So negative, this was the man who felt depressed afterwards. And then confusion. Confusion is very common when somebody was not told their accurate label. There's a case here of a woman who was convinced she had borderline personality disorder, even though her provider told her she had borderline traits, but she felt like she couldn't participate in support groups and so on because she wasn't a member of the group. So the number one patient recommendation, I explicitly asked them, how would you tell someone, having been through what you've been through, if you were a provider? They all recommend honesty. One young woman said, it's like that scene in Girl Interrupted, where she goes and she looks up her own medical file because they won't tell her. It's obviously not that same situation, but I just wish they'd really be upfront with me. So the conclusion here is that there's a huge disconnect between the perceived patient benefit and the actual patient benefit of this communication strategy. So clinicians are overestimating the impact of stigma on their patients, and they're underestimating the effect of dishonesty. Because every single patient who found out their provider had kept the diagnosis a secret left treatment. Every single one. So better communication with patients offers the opportunity for improved treatment participation and adherence. And I just want to thank the Holt Center for Science and Technology Studies for helping fund this research and our contact information.